This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Say the word suburbs, and for many people, a familiar picture comes to mind. A split-level house with a manicured lawn and a white picket fence. The lifestyle? Office by day, satellite TV at night, kids' soccer games on the weekends. And the people? Mostly white and middle class. The stereotype of the suburbs is homogeneity, but like most stereotypes, it doesn't hold up well under examination. The truth is that the number of immigrants choosing suburban life is on the rise. It's not just families with 2.5 children. Single people live in the suburbs, more of them too, and the elderly, and more of them too. If you spend a little time in a suburban strip mall, you just might find an art movie house between Applebee's and the Olive Garden. Today, we begin a series on the suburbs by trying to define them. Are they still the Levittowns of the 1950s or the 90s boomburbs with high-rises and industrial parks? More than half of us live there now. Why? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And emailers, we have a special challenge for you. What is the defining characteristic of the suburb? Send us your definition at TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A to help explore darkest suburbia is Robert Lang, director of the Metropolitan Institute at Virginia Tech, co-editor of the book Redefining Urban and Suburban America, Evidence from the Census 2003. And Robert, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me.
First, let's go back a bit. And suburbs become a part of the American consciousness when?
Mid-19th century. In the early 19th century, there were these kind of border regions at the edge of big cities. Now, at this point, a big city is a place you could walk from one end to the other. You could walk across Boston, you know, and into the countryside. And at this edge is kind of, you know, things that people don't want really near them, like tanneries and so on. And a few brave souls start to live at this edge and commute in on the worst kind of public transportation that humans have ever devised, which is a horse-drawn omnibus, which is you sit in a big box and a horse drags you along and it's not a very pleasant experience.
Well, transportation has been the key to the establishment of suburbs ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Railroads to begin with?
Even before railroads, you had horse-drawn streetcars. You had, you know, just taking the act of taking the box and putting it on rail increased the speed and created a whole new kind of suburbia, the first kind of suburbia where people who were more affluent than those in the city center began living.
And then after the Second World War, of course, and the enormous explosion in the numbers of cars, that is when you get the, quintessentially American suburb, the Levittown definition.
The cars, the roads, the mass suburbanization, the suburbs of the public mind.
Describe those for us.
Post-World War II suburbs were really large speculative ventures built by sort of, you know, developer entrepreneurs, if you will, that saw the opportunity that places like, you know, the big metropolitan areas offered, the big beltways that went around them, went through virgin territory at first and offered access to the rest of the city and to employment that had, you know, never been known before.
Suburbs, though, as an idea, they were a lot of the time defined by what they weren't. I mean, they weren't the big city and they weren't the countryside.
Yeah, I mean, it's different than in the 19th century, you also had this category of satellite city. And what it was is a kind of shrunk down version of the big city that was a galaxy of these little places around the big city. And that's not what a suburb was. A suburb was distinct, and in some cases so distinct that in places like Llewellyn Park in Orange, New Jersey, you had what's known as a picturesque suburb, where the residents consciously made it so that it was not a city, put in a kind of forestry that didn't look urban, put in sidewalks that didn't look urban, made it, you know, so that it was a reaction to the city.
And in the other hand, you had a lot of places that did look particularly urban. If you look around in Long Island, outside of New York City, where the train would let people off, those were little cities that developed there.
Yeah, especially around the train stop, you'd get a little sort of, you know, strip of commerce and so on. And that evolved into the strip mall later on, of course.
Mm-hmm. Now, one stereotype is often that we're talking about who lives there now or who lived there. But the suburbs were all white. Was that ever true?
No, it was never true. Nothing's all anything, but it was at one point predominantly white, as was the nation.
And how has it changed?
It is now essentially a new kind of city because it has so much of everything that there's no way you can say it's any one thing. It's as diverse as the nation in a way. What's characteristic of it, though, is that it is auto-dependent and lower density. It's a new kind of city in that it's strung out over much bigger space than a traditional city. But it's like a city in that it has everything. It has low-income housing. It has business. It has shopping. It has every kind of funk and, you know, the kind of the small places that people usually associate with cities. In the strip shopping center, is that, you know, between the Applebee's, between the Formula restaurant, is this interesting bookstore and so on? And you see that increasingly in the suburbs.
Funk is not a word most people associate with the suburbs. They're much more likely to apply a word like vanilla.
And in some cases, they're right. But increasingly, I think the funk of the suburbs is what you're going to hear about. In fact, interestingly enough, there's a new series on Fox called The O.C. And what struck me about it is, number one, it's, you know, finally Hollywood has discovered Orange County, California, and it got into a time machine and went back to 1965 and found the same rich, bratty kids that live on, you know, in Beverly Hills, if you will. And yet the interesting thing about Orange County is the funk, is the fact that Orange County now is an alternative to Los Angeles, and that hip people from Los Angeles, believe it or not, travel down to Orange County, go to clubs, shop for things they can't find in Los Angeles. That in itself is interesting.
Being from the other coast, I have to admit, it took me a long time to figure out what the O.C. was. Ocean City, why are they making this big TV show about Ocean City? The suburbs, the interesting fact that a lot of people derive from the last census, and we could see it around us, was that many big cities were undergoing a revival. People were moving back in. We overlooked the fact that at the same time, the suburbs continued to grow faster.
Yeah. And in that book I wrote, actually, with Bruce, one of the pieces that I wrote was about that urban revival. And at the same time, I also documented what we termed boomburbs. And places like Mesa, Arizona are now bigger than Minneapolis and St. Louis and big cities like that. And they are essentially mostly suburban, single-family homes, lower density places.
We're getting some responses to our email challenge. What is it that is the defining characteristic of the suburb? Ellie writes from Lee Summit, a suburb of Kansas City. Where I live, there is only one word that expresses suburbia: SUV. And from Brian Signorelli in Little Rock, Arkansas, what defines a suburb? One word: Walmart. And from David Concannon in Indianapolis, Indiana, strip malls. I'll always remember Douglas Copeland's line about growing up in suburbia. To paraphrase, it doesn't matter where you're from, we all had the same stores in our strip malls. All of those things, well, you know, there's a grain of truth in all of them, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, in fact, I told, I can't recall which paper recently, when I was growing up, I used to watch The Flintstones, and The Flintstones had a unique set. It was in Bedrock, and they had very cheap animation. And when you went through Bedrock, when Fred drove through Bedrock, if you'll recall, anybody from, you know, 30s and 40s in that age range will remember this, the scenery repeated. It was always the same place, again and again. It was on a loop. And some of the suburbs are really like that, but the issue is, what do you find inside the loop? Is it that there's the same stores from one loop to the next? And in the past, that was definitely the case. And I think increasingly what's in the strip malls is more interesting. The better Chinese restaurants in Los Angeles are in strip malls in the San Gabriel Valley. They're not in downtown, for example.
We are looking for the defining characteristic of the suburb. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And let's join Eve, who's with us on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, I'm just so excited to be on here. And I'm African American, and I live in a suburb of Minneapolis. And I looked at our census figures just a few weeks ago, and when I first moved there, it said there were 3 black people in the whole city. And now, in just my development, we've got 3 different families. It's a new development, and just besides having African Americans like myself, 2 of my neighbors are going to be Laotian. Indian is another family. Then I've got some Vietnamese. And this is just on one block of the development.
It sounds like you're going to have a hard time running into Eddie Haskell or the Beeve.
Well, you know what? It's funny because we've out of the homes that are occupied on the street so far, only 4 of the families are white.
There go our stereotypes, Robert Lang.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, there is a ring of distant suburbs that are emerging, you know, way out there, places that people thought of as kind of, you know, summer vacation lands, if you will, or summer camp places that are still white in a way that suburbs were white in the 1970s, which is to say they're predominantly white.
I thought it was going to be like that when I moved out there, and I didn't ask the development about any diversity issues when we moved. I just liked the area. So we didn't ask about it. We got to looking around and going to introduce ourselves to neighbors as we moved in, and there's all different kinds of people, and it's been great. And I'm glad that that my son is going to be able to go to a good school with lots of different people, and that I'm not going to have to send him down into a Minneapolis school just to be around other kids that have different cultural backgrounds.
It sounds like you're really excited about this, Eve.
Yeah, I am.
And where did you move from?
Actually, I moved up to Minnesota from Savannah, Georgia.
So this is quite a trip for you.
Oh, yeah, and it's a big flip-flop because Savannah has a very large African-American population. Minneapolis, Minnesota as a whole, just do not. But Minneapolis also has a lot of immigrants from Somalia and other parts of Africa. And then there's a large Hmong population from Laos. There's a lot of different people that come to this area, and it's great.
And Prince and Dave Winfield are both from Minneapolis, too, so that you may run into them.
Yeah.
Okay.
You too.
Thanks very much for the call, Eve.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Payam, and Payam joins us from Orange County, California. OC, as I'm beginning to find out.
The OC, as Fox Television has found out and so graciously bestowed us with national attention, the quintessential American suburb, which happens to have quite a bit of beachfront property on it. I grew up here as an immigrant. Just wanted to briefly comment that I think it's very dangerous for younger people under the age of 35 to remain in a suburb.
I assume you're talking psychically, not physically.
I'm sorry?
I assume you're talking about their psyche and not their physical danger.
I think depression is psychic and physical.
Okay.
And, there's a sense of mental conformity behind all of the aesthetic prettiness that can cause depression just due to a sense of, oblivion and detachment from the rest of the world. It's what we're known for overseas. It's just the sense of picket fences, SUVs. Everything is large, very consumption-oriented environment. The suburbs are the quintessential kind of bubble that harnesses all of that. And it really kind of detaches us from what's going on. I mean, it's very simple to have a cable or satellite link, do your 80 hours of work, watch the kids play soccer, and then just drown yourself in what's spoon-fed to you because you're just very happy to have, your 2.5 acres and your pick and fence and everything. And just
well, let's get Robert Lang get a response to this.
There are parts of, if you will, the OC that are like that. And in fact, they probably should have named the show Newport Beach 902, whatever. I'm not sure what the zip code is. But the fact is that Orange County's on the edge, leading edge of a kind of new diverse America. Big parts of Orange County, places that are quintessentially American, like Anaheim, are more diverse than Brooklyn, New York. They have a larger native-born population. They have a larger Hispanic, Asian population. And, in fact, this is the place that, Walt stepped out and thought was a suitable part of America. It has changed so dramatically that the public consciousness has not caught up with it. And I think that's the part of Orange County that's fun.
Payam, it sounds like you see very much that it's shot through a vanilla filter, if you will, that there is this overwhelming blandness.
Yeah, and I completely acknowledge the racial diversity of counties like this. But what I'm talking about is just a sense of mental flight. People come here for a reason. They don't want to have to deal with the, metropolitan environment obviously has its bad and its good. What I would include in as good is a sense of immediate connection to other parts of the world, which frankly people flee. It's not necessarily just a white flight issue like Orange County is blamed for. It's just a sense of a mental flight. We want to get away from the bigger problems.
Okay, Payam, thanks very much for your call.
Yeah.
Here's an email we got from Lisa in St. Louis. I grew up in the suburbs and vowed I'd never live there as an adult. I graduated from college and immediately went urban. 20 years later, my husband and I just purchased my parents' home. Where? Back in the burbs. Why? Sidewalks, schools, and social lives. My parents' neighborhood now offers us those things that my parents sought in the 70s. Other people busy with kids in PTA meetings and soccer practice, and we love it. More on the burbs after a break. It's NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we are talking about the suburbs. What are they and how accurate are the caricatures that we often draw of them? You're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us with your definition of the suburbs. Our address is TOTN@npr.org. Brad Acker of Boise, Idaho, emailed us with this definition. It seems to me, he wrote, all true suburbs are named after what they have driven out, such as Fox Ridge, Hunter's Woods, Pheasant Run. That from Boise, Idaho. Our guest is Robert Lang, director of the Metropolitan Institute at Virginia Tech. Joining us now by phone from Tofte, Minnesota, is Myron Orfield. He's professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, the author of the book American Metropolitics, The New Suburban Reality. Myron, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you for having me.
In your studies, you found that the idea of suburbs being an affluent monolith is false. What is the current state of America's suburbs?
Well, there's at least three kinds of places, I think, that people think of suburbs. One, I call at-risk suburbs. These are places that are about 40% of U.S. metropolitan areas. They're fully developed. They're not developing anymore, and they're beginning to become quite diverse, like the cities that they surround. They're struggling with older malls and commercial industrial spaces. They're trying to redevelop themselves. They are essentially dealing with urban problems and, in many ways, more fragile than the cities they surround. Another group of suburbs I call the bedroom developing suburbs. These are places that are overwhelmed by children. These are the very white places that Robert Lang is talking about. They're not dealing with poverty or old infrastructure. They're dealing with an enormous number of kids and the inability to develop a tax base that will support their schools or infrastructure in a completely substantial way. A final group, about 10%, is what I call affluent job centers, and these are the places that Robert writes about in his book, a concentration of job activity and high-valued homes, not as much affordable housing. These are places that are beginning to really become the edge cities of modern metropolitan America. They're very different. These are different kinds of places, and they're moving in different trajectories, I think.
Who lives in suburbs? If it's the more than half of us now, it's presumably it's us that lives in suburbs.
It is us that lives in suburbs. African-American and Latino and Asian middle-class people are moving into suburbs with increasing numbers. A majority are moving out into the suburbs. White people obviously live in suburbs in even more substantial numbers. It's the whole country, and the suburbs are becoming as diverse as we are, although not all the suburbs are. It's mainly the older and fully developed ones that are beginning to experience immigration and diversity in the way that we're talking about today.
Another cliche about the suburbs used to be that working-class Democrats used to rent in the city, and as soon as they moved out to the suburbs, they became property-owning Republicans.
Well, the suburbs are a battleground in politics, and I think that cliche isn't true either. Just as the suburbs aren't diverse, they're not politically diverse. When I wrote my book in 1998, the suburbs were almost exactly evenly divided in the congressional level and the state legislative level between Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats tend to be stronger in the older, more fully developed suburbs. The Republicans had a more majority in the developing places, although in 1998, those developing places were a battleground. In the last election, the Republicans did better in those bedroom developing places than the Democrats did.
Let's get our listeners back involved. 800-989-8255. And Catherine called us, and she's in Long Beach, California.
Hi.
Hi, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi. My question was, when does a suburb become a city? I live in Long Beach, California, which is situated almost exactly between Los Angeles and Orange County, and I sort of feel that Long Beach has the best of both of those areas without the worst portions of it. But is Long Beach a city or is it a suburb? That's basically my question. I can take my answer off the air.
Well, one piece of advice, Catherine, if you think it's the best, don't tell anybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's get an answer from both of our guests. And Myron Orfield, you first.
Well, Long Beach is definitely a city in terms of its municipal power. You know, a city is the definition of what the city can do, and under California law, it's definitely a city. Now, it's not a central city, and that's defined by the census, which is the large urban city that is sort of the signature city of the region. Most suburbs in the United States are cities. They are formally cities in the sense that they have that full array of municipal powers. A smaller number are villages and townships that are like cities. They have land use planning powers, but they don't have the full battery of powers that a so-called city has under law. So these places are cities. They're just not the central cities or the signature cities of the region.
Robert Lang?
It's actually an older satellite.
Go ahead, Robert.
It's an older satellite city. It's down at the port. It is to Los Angeles like Newark is to New York. And what's interesting is Los Angeles is a city that's mostly single-family dwellings or small apartment buildings, and Long Beach mimics that. What's really suburban in Southern California is what's known as the Inland Empire, way out there in the Moreno Valley.
I think it would prefer to think of itself as more like a Piraeus and Athens. I don't think anybody wants to compare themselves to Newark right now. Let's go to Ryan, who's on the line with us from Graham, North Carolina.
Yes. I've lived in suburbs my whole life. I'm 19. I found that pretty much the defining characteristic of a suburb is not what it has, but what it's missing. And the two things that it's missing is an office building and a farm.
They
can have both.
Yeah, they could have both, couldn't they, Myron?
Yeah, they certainly can. I mean, there's a group of suburbs in the United States, the ones that I call the affluent job centers, that have about four times their share of office market space, and their share is consolidating. They're much more likely, even than a central city, pound for pound, to have office space, and it's some of the most high-value and strong office space in the metropolitan area. Now, most suburbs never do develop office space. Most suburbs never do develop a significant commercial industrial base that they need to fund their schools or public services. But a small share of them, these affluent job centers, really know how to get office space.
Robert, did you want to get in on that?
And as a whole, these suburbs outweigh the city in terms of total office space. So it's definitely possible to have an office building in the suburbs. And it's also possible to have an office building in the suburbs next to a farm, which is the interesting combination of suburbia. If you think of the area of Princeton, New Jersey, it's like the office in the Dell. There's, deer coming up to the window. There's tractors outside, and these glass windows. And, it's all mishmash together there.
Thanks, Ryan. And let's see if we get a question from Will. And Will joins us from Cleveland.
Yes. I live about 15, 20 miles outside of Cleveland, Ohio. Where I guess it's called Lakewood, Ohio.
Yeah.
And we don't have no strip malls. It's really culturally diverse. I heard it's the most densest city from Chicago to New York, and I was just wondering if this is true.
Yeah, Lakewood is an old streetcar suburb that was developed in the turn of the century. It's a beautiful urban place that's dealing with issues of gentrification like the cities do. It is a dense place. It's a culturally interesting and diverse place. It's also struggling a little bit to maintain its place in the metropolitan area as it's competing with some of the really powerful commercial and industrial developing suburbs to the southeast. But I think what you said about Lakewood's very true.
Well, Robert Lang, you do have this category of cities that used to be far out and sort of engulfed by sprawl, right?
That's what's interesting about the suburbs. They're really a mosaic. There's 150 years plus of building these places. So yesterday's suburbs look very city-like, and new suburbs are where people think of as the suburbs. It's almost as much a process as it is a place because it's constantly redefined by the edge of the region.
Will, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And we are talking with Myron Orfield and Robert Lang about what it is that defines the word suburbia. Last week, the Chicago Tribune ran a three-part series on the suburbs called Unauthorized Suburbia. In it, Tribune staff explored the suburbs that surround the Windy City to seek out history, peculiar spots of interest, and do's and don'ts for when one travels outside the city limits. What the staff found is that suburbs are not all bland wastelands of strip malls. Included in the series was a top 10 list on why the suburbs rule. And joining us now from his vacation in Memphis, Tennessee, is Chicago Tribune writer and suburbanite Steve Johnson. Steve, good of you to take time off from your break.
Thanks, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here.
So why did you have to prove that the suburbs rule?
Well, that's kind of one of the essences of suburbia, isn't it? That there's a bit of a culture of apology. I live in Oak Park, Illinois, but it's okay. We have a downtown.
I see, yes. And some of those, a couple of pretty good architects used to live in Oak Park.
Yeah, a fair writer, too, by the name of Hemingway, I think it was.
I think that was his name.
Yeah. We last summer we did this unauthorized guide to the city and realized there's a whole lot of rich stuff out in the suburbs, too, that ought to be explored and ought to be explained to people, that it's not just a vast wasteland of shopping malls and Olive Garden.
Well, the stigma attached to the burbs, as you mentioned, is, that vanilla idea.
Right.
Is there culture? Is there variety?
Oh, I think absolutely. I'm sure your guests have been talking about this with a lot more immigrants moving directly to the suburbs now. Strong ethnic enclaves in the suburbs. You have diverse restaurants. You have, you have coffee shops everywhere. I think the kind of animating idea is they're not as bad as they used to be.
Well,
it ain't downtown Chicago, but it's not what it used to be either.
So there's no reason really to be ashamed to admit that you live in Oak Park.
Yeah, although I have to admit, my wife, hearing about this, she's down here with me and the kids, and she said, "You're going to go on national radio and admit we live in the suburbs?"
Well, one of the reasons you wrote that the suburbs rule, number one reason was parking. Don't laugh, you write, it matters.
It does matter. And, you know, as much a fan as I am of the streetscape and, you know, not having a parking lot directly in front of a shopping plaza and all that, it certainly makes life a heck of a lot easier. I will defend the idea of parking, although I wouldn't necessarily want to live near a parking lot.
Malls is number five on your list. Tell me you'd rather be walking on Michigan Avenue on a Saturday.
Yeah, and of course the line that we cut out of there because we thought it was a little too harsh was you'll be bumping into suburbanites gazing around, you know, at every step.
Michigan Avenue.
On Michigan Avenue, right. The idea that there's a lot more congestion downtown. There's some of this is obviously a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but in terms of kind of convenience of life and cost of living and all that, I think you do get a bit of a break away from the central city.
Well, perhaps in the tongue-in-cheek side, reason number 10, more of minivans and SUVs and the exciting people who drive them.
Yeah, this goes back again. I don't want to paint my marriage in such an interesting light on radio, but my wife and I are having the minivan debate now, and I am pro, and she's kind of thinking, this will ruin what's left of her image. And I'm saying, what image? You know, we have two kids. We live in the suburbs. Let's just get the minivan.
If she's got an image left, I'd suggest you put it on eBay today.
Because there we go.
After you buy the minivan.
Yes.
One real question, though, more seriously. The high taxes is reason number three. Because you write, forking over to the government each month what you used to pay in rent says, I'm somebody. And you note, it also pays for the schools.
Yeah, there's kind of a double-edged thing there. Certainly when we were looking at houses, the suburban taxes were a lot higher than the taxes in many city neighborhoods. But the other side of that is that you get a kind of more reliable school system. So it's just a trade-off. I mean, in our personal case, the big mistake was moving out when the kids, you know, before the first child was born, so we get 6 years of taxes and no school to make up for it.
And are you and your wife already planning for the day that your youngest packs up and heads off for the University of Chicago or Northwestern or wherever it is he happens to go to school, or he or she, and say, you know, that's the light at the end of the tunnel, and that's the day we move back to the city?
And we have talked about that, funny enough, yeah. Or also the day when he rejects everything that we at that point stand for and moves into the city in some basement garret somewhere and spurns all our values, you know.
Yeah, if you moved into a basement garret now, he'd move out to the suburbs. You're going to lose either way there.
There you go.
Steve Johnson, thanks very much.
Thanks, Neil.
Steve Johnson is the TV critic for the Chicago Tribune. He contributed to its Unauthorized Suburbia series, and we reached him by phone from near the suburbs of Memphis. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And still with us are Myron Orfield. He's the author of American Metropolitics. And Robert Lang is also with us, a director of the Metropolitan Institute at the Virginia Technical Institute in Studio 3A. Let's get back to the phones. And joining us now is Jeff, who's with us from Irvine, California. That's a suburb.
It certainly is. In fact, when we talk about the new OC show, I'm surprised that he didn't call it Irvine 92612. Irvine, I believe, is the largest master planned community in the U.S. It's been in existence about 30 years and has even its own University of California location, University of California at Irvine. And my kids, my wife's a native Orange County girl, grew up in Anaheim, and my kids look your typical California blonde hair, blue eye stereotype. Yet the school that they attend, my children are, my son is one of three and my daughter is one of four Anglos in their school. And in fact, while dropping them off in the mornings, it's less likely to hear English than you will of many other conversations happening. And specifically in our area of 150,000 people, we have a very large Middle Eastern and Asian population, primarily Chinese and Korean, which brings some really interesting dynamics because in this particular suburb, instead of embracing and integrating, they found that the best way to live in the suburbs is to continue to maintain their cultural connection, through using their first language. And it's just a really interesting dynamic in what I think is probably the prototypical suburban city.
Myron Orfield, is people moving, immigrants moving into suburbs do it because other immigrants live there, isn't that right?
That's true. I mean, we all follow communities. When our forebears immigrated to places where there was a strong root of the community that we came, and certain different types of immigrants are immigrating to different parts of metropolitan America. Often Asians and Latinos are moving directly to certain types of suburbs in the metropolitan areas, depending on their affluence, education level, kind of communities that exist as a whole. California is one of the most interesting places in the country, although a lot of the large metropolitan areas are experiencing really interesting and new immigration trends.
Robert Lang?
What's also interesting is that in the 19th century or the early 20th century, you'd have a Italian neighborhood, say, in Lower Manhattan, and you had Mulberry Street, and you had a few blocks that were dense. What you can do now because of technology is you can live at much lower density because of automobiles, the internet, and gather together across many square miles what would have consumed old New York. Let's say an Indian community in northern Middlesex County, New Jersey, which is notable. And you get that all across Los Angeles.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Let's see if we get some one-word definitions. One-word definitions of suburbia. Jolene joins us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello. Mine would have to be leaf blowers.
Ah, snow blowers goes right in there, too. But that's depending on what part of the country you're from, Jolene.
Yeah, you're trying to get in Oregon, you're trying to get a calm autumn afternoon, and all of a sudden you're from like four different directions.
Okay, Jolene, thanks very much. And a one-word definition of suburbia from Rhea in Beaverton, Oregon.
Oh, it's a garage door opener.
That's a good one. We got an email, one from Mike Fisher in Kalamazoo, Michigan. What is a suburb, he writes? If it has a professional sports team, it is not a suburb. Rhea, thanks very much for the call. And the people of East Rutherford, New Jersey, would beg to differ with Mike Fisher.
And Anaheim and Arlington, Texas.
Okay. And our guests, thank you both very much. Myron and Robert, we appreciate it. Myron, good to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Myron Orfield is a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School and the author of American Metropolitics, The New Suburban Reality. We reached him in Minnesota. Robert Lang is director of the Metropolitan Institute at Virginia Tech and co-editor of Redefining Urban and Suburban America, Evidence from Census 2000. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, an economist explains whether a jobless recovery is good news or bad news. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.